The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, good friends. Hope you had a good week. And now it's time to wrap it all up right here on the Bill Press Pod with our Reporters Roundtable. Well, for weeks we've been warned that the worst was going to happen, total worldwide economic collapse, because Republicans and Democrats were so divided they'd never come up with a plan to keep the United States from going belly up. But the sky didn't fall after all. Biden and McCarthy made a deal, it passed the House, it's now passed the Senate, and suddenly things look almost rosy for the next 2 years. So what happened? Who gets the credit or the blame? Does this mean that bipartisanship is back? And meanwhile, every other week it seems the Republican primary gets more crowded. Last week it was Ron DeSantis and Tim Scott. Next week it's Chris Christie and Mike Pence. How many more are waiting in the wings, and do any of them really have a chance of stealing the nomination from Donald Trump? So much to talk about. So let's jump right into it with today's panel. Ginger Gibson, Senior Washington Editor, NBC News Digital. Hello, Ginger.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Gabe DeBenedetti, National Correspondent for New York Magazine. Hi, Gabe. Welcome back.
Howdy, Bill. Good to be here.
And also from NBC News, political reporter Alan Smith. Hi, Alan.
Always a pleasure to be here, Bill.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So, for those of us who live on Capitol Hill, there was the smell of jambalaya in the air last night from one household, the Gibson household. Jambalaya in honor of the Senate about to pass the big deficit debt ceiling deal. So, Ginger, how did we go from what was supposed to be the big bang to almost a whimper?
It did seem to peter out and pass just in a way that was not shocking or nerve-wracking after weeks. And you're right, I did make jambalaya for dinner last night in honor of the Louisiana nature of this legislation that we saw passed. Garrett Graves, one of the lead Republican negotiators from Baton Rouge, or from Louisiana, represents Baton Rouge. Shalonda Young, the director of OMB, also from Baton Rouge, one of the top White House negotiators. We know that last week they were in the same room watching the LSU women's basketball team visit the White House, myself included, maybe quite possibly the biggest LSU women's basketball fan that there is. So it had these Louisiana ties that brought them together and that helped them to negotiate this legislation. But you're right. We spent weeks sort of wringing our hands, very worried this wasn't going to happen, this unprecedented default. What would happen? The economy would collapse. We would lose thousands of jobs. And they got it done. And they got it done in the most old-fashioned Washington way, behind closed doors, hammering it out, building personal relationships, building trust, and doing it in a way that they got their members on board. This was one of the most overwhelmingly bipartisan bills we've seen Congress pass that is controversial. Right? That isn't naming a post office. And I think that we're going to hear both parties really talking this up. Biden's going to say, look, I brought back normal Washington and got things done. And Republicans are going to say, we used our leverage to get some cuts.
Yeah. So what about that, Gabe? You know, McCarthy is out there saying this is the biggest savings, the biggest cut in spending in the history of humankind, a huge victory for me and for Republicans. And Biden, who's been fairly quiet, though, is also saying this shows that I was right. I can make government work. I can get things done. And I saved the world from economic collapse. So both sides right? Or what's going on? How do you read it? Who benefits?
You mean to tell me that someone in Washington is claiming credit or claiming political benefit for a deal?
Yeah, I mean, Oh, no.
The actual process here was not necessarily all that did not go exactly as many people expected. I want to be clear that I think we should take a step back and say it's not just because the parties were very far away on this. It's because Biden entered this part of his term saying, I'm not going to negotiate with these guys. And McCarthy said, you know, we're essentially said, we're going to extort some stuff out of the this whole situation. So it seemed like a totally incompatible situation. And Biden essentially said, well, I guess I don't have a choice but to negotiate here. I think they both have reason to be happy. The in terms of the actual substance of the policy of the deal, neither is thrilled. But I think the thing that we have to keep in mind is that for McCarthy, this was an exercise in trying to strike the right balance where he didn't alienate enough of his own caucus to lose his job. I mean, he has such a tiny margin, and don't forget how hard it was for him to get the job in the first place, that, you know, he really had to make sure that he could figure out a way to sell this as a real conservative victory while still making sure that it could get enough Democratic votes to actually pass, because he knew that some of his, you know, hardline right wingers were going to defect. So real tightrope act here. Biden isn't out there cheering this, of course, because he doesn't want to have to submit to this kind of thing every time the debt ceiling comes up for debate, or you know, every time we reach the debt ceiling. And he'd rather move on. But does this prove his central point that bipartisanship is back and that regular Washington order can work? Yeah, of course it does.
Mm-hmm. So, Alan, I guess both of them, right, McCarthy and Biden, can say, hey, you may not like this deal, but it could have been a hell of a lot worse, right, on each side.
Exactly. And really, that's why, at least on the surface, it really seems like it's a win for both Biden and McCarthy. Biden, because this deal is nowhere near as bad as what some people were projecting it could be in the weeks running up to this. And McCarthy just being able to get a deal that would be approved by enough members of his caucus to get it through. I found it interesting that, you know, when the deal was first made, you saw a lot of these far right members come out and say, you know, he caved. This is nowhere near what we wanted to get, so on and so forth. And you felt as if that dam could break, but it really did not. There weren't a bunch of additional people who came out after that initial night. And, you know, this is another instance where, you know, you felt going into it, McCarthy might not have had what it takes, but, you know, he does come out of here with a deal that he can sell. He can talk about the cuts that were made. They did get some stuff out of this that, you know, can be brought back home and talked about on the trail in these districts. But he also was able to do this in a way where, you know, Democrats were going to end up voting for it, at least enough of them. And it's not the kind of situation where there's going to be a ton of animosity between the parties, specifically over this, now that it's passed.
Well, in fact, it could be said, and here is the Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries, pointed out that in the end, though McCarthy did take the lead in forcing a deal, that his butt was saved in the end by Democrats who voted for the procedural method to get it to the floor, and then provided more votes than McCarthy was able to round up. Here's Leader Jeffries.
Earlier today, 29 House Republicans voted to default on our nation's debt and against an agreement that you negotiated. It's an extraordinary act that indicates just the nature of the extremism that is out of control on the other side of the aisle. Extreme MAGA Republicans attempted to take control of the House floor. Democrats took it back for the American people. And we will continue to do what is necessary under the leadership of President Joe Biden.
So in a sense, Ginger, it was a good moment for Jeffries too, right? Delivering where he had to deliver.
Yeah, I mean, we saw Jeffries keep the caucus together, you know, a little bit of complaining there at the end, but that was expected. We actually thought he may lose more Democrats than he did because of the cut. So I really was able to coast a bit through his first controversy, through his first crisis, maybe. Controversy is the word, crisis is the word. But, you know, there will be times for him to have, I think, his Nancy Pelosi moments down the road where, you know, you're trying to have a leader-to-leader negotiation in the House or in Congress. But the president sort of held on to this one and got it done. And I think Jeffries was able to just stand up and say, look, we support the president. And for Democrats, there's so much sort of hand-wringing all the time. It's sometimes hard to distinguish, is this more hand-wringing than usual? But when they're looking ahead to next year's election, this was kind of a moment to really show what it looks like when they have to sort of like something they don't really love, and maybe a candidate, presidential candidate that they like, and they like some of the things he's done, but they don't get excited and love what it looks like. This might have been a little microcosm of that.
So, by the way, I think for the record, we should make sure everyone understands that the vote in the House was 314 to 117 in favor, and in the Senate last night was 63 to 36. So it really wasn't a nail biter. It really wasn't close when it came down to the final vote. But Gabe, you know, so it went from, oh, the economy is going to collapse, to, okay, we'll save the economy, but Kevin McCarthy is going to lose his speakership as a result of it. That became, you know, sort of the theme. Here was Ken Buck from Colorado. Certainly all the Freedom Caucus members weren't really happy with McCarthy's leadership on this. So Buck says, this isn't the end of it.
The speaker promised that we would operate at 2022 appropriations levels when he got the support to be speaker. He's now changed that to 2023 levels plus 1%. That's a major change for a lot of people. And so after this vote, and he will win the vote tonight, but after this vote, we will have discussions about whether there should be a motion to vacate or not.
Is that just an empty threat, Gabe, do you think? The Freedom Caucus have that kind of strength, or does McCarthy come out stronger than ever?
Well, it can always be somewhere in between, and likely is. But not to diminish the question, I think that is exactly what McCarthy is sort of staying up at night wondering right now. But there is a pretty big gulf between the far right wing of his party. You know, sort of these, some of them are fringe members, some of them represent a little bit more of the mainstream, but certainly these people who are more in the threatening wing, let's put it that way, there's a pretty big gulf between them threatening him and actually doing something, because trying to get rid of him as speaker may not be very difficult. Trying to replace him as speaker with an actual candidate is the hard part. You know, a lot of the calculus that goes into all of this, and it has gone into these negotiations over the last few weeks on the Republican side, the Democratic side too, but to a lesser extent, is who is the political fallout going to, you know, redound to more aggressively if this doesn't work? And the Republicans clearly, McCarthy clearly calculated that, you know, he could not afford to let the country go into default for the obvious reasons, but also because politically speaking, it would be a disaster for his party. Those in his caucus don't necessarily have the same calculus as him, but they also understand that if they were to, you know, try and get rid of him right now and then try to replace him, we get an even more extreme version of the, you know, 15 rounds of voting, questions about the future of the Republican Party. Really, what they want to do is keep the focus on the Democrats right now and on Biden himself. So there's not a lot of appetite for that kind of procedural fight that's going to go, that would have to go down on Capitol Hill. But they can certainly likely will just try to make his life difficult in, you know, 15 other different ways over the next few months.
And Alan, here's one of the things that I found interesting. So once a deal was done, Donald Trump came out and said it's a bad deal. Republicans should default rather than take this deal. Ron DeSantis came out and said it's a bad deal, implying that people should vote against it. Mike Pence came out and said it's a bad deal. Republicans in the House should not go for it. And yet, look what happened. What does that tell us about these big presidential candidates or the party or anything?
I don't know if it says more about the presidential candidates than it does the reality that, you know, the debt ceiling has to be lifted. It is non-negotiable. It is a great point of leverage for the party out of power in the White House when, you know, they have the opportunity to basically use the debt ceiling as the ultimate leverage point, get some additional things that they would like to see happen. But ultimately, it has to be raised. So if McCarthy is coming out with this deal and he's saying this is basically the best thing that we can get, for a lot of members, you know, that's basically going to be the final line, because not voting for it and actually allowing for the debt ceiling to not be lifted and leading to that default, I mean, that just really is not an option. And I know that all through this negotiating process, as you know, has been the case in many debt ceiling negotiating processes in the past, there was this sense that this might really be the time that, you know, there's no deal and that the U.S. defaults and, you know, it's never been this bad. And, you know, we get to the finish line and there's a deal, you know, like has been it every time in the past. It's just a situation where even if you've got prominent people saying this is a bad deal, don't vote for it. Really, for a lot of these guys, there is no choice.
Yeah. And by the way, I noticed that Trump in all of his comments did not attack my Kevin personally for leading the fight to get a deal. So even his remarks were somewhat tempered, I guess. Well, look, enough of the debt ceiling talk. The GOP primary is about to get a hell of a lot more interesting with Chris Christie and Mike Pence jumping in next week. Let's take a quick break here on the Bill Press Pod and our today's roundtable, and then we will jump in with both feet into the Republican primary, where it stands today and where it is heading. And we'll be back with Alan Smith, Gabe DeBenedetti, and Ginger Gibson. And today's roundtable on the Bill Press Pod is brought to you by the American Federation of Government Employees, the good men and women of the AFGE, the largest of our federal employee unions, representing over 750,000 federal employees under the leadership of President Everett Kelly. They're the men and women who take care of our government agencies, who provide the staff on our government agencies, not only in Washington, D.C., but across the country. From the EPA to the Department of Energy, Department of Transportation, Department of Agriculture, the Treasury, the IRS, all of the federal agencies, they're serving us 24/7 around the clock, year in, year out, no matter who's in the White House, doing great work. We appreciate their great work. The members of the AFGE, and particularly grateful for their support, longtime support of the Bill Press Pod.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back with today's roundtable on this Friday, June 2nd. Joining us, Alan Smith, political reporter for NBC News, Gabe DeBenedetti, national correspondent for the New York Magazine, and Ginger Gibson, senior Washington editor for NBC News Digital. Next week, two more jumping in. Chris Christie on Tuesday up in New Hampshire. So, Gabe, he is being called the wild card in the Republican primary, the only one who's willing so far to go out there and really publicly take on Donald Trump. Is there a lane in the primary for that kind of an open opponent?
I mean, anytime you consider the candidacy of Chris Christie, especially with respect to the question of how he's going after Trump, I think you need to consider two things. One is Christie's reputation, which is terrible among both Democrats and Republicans. His numbers are truly awful. And the other is this massive asterisk around the idea that he's going to be the Trump antagonist in the race. And that asterisk is he was with Trump until the final days of the Trump presidency, was the first, you know, to endorse him, the first of his former opponents to endorse him in 2016, and only jumped from the Trump ship when Trump almost killed him by giving him COVID. So let's
we need
to be very clear about the idea that Christie is some sort of principled defender of democracy, et cetera, and opposing Trump for any reason, or that he's, you know, been some sort of steadfast Trump antagonist. You know, this is really a problem, though, that a lot of the folks on the Republican side are dealing with, which is that they are trying to pick at a non-Trump lane while also having, you know, immense records of having supported him. Now, you could argue that there are a lot of voters out there who that describes, that they're going after voters who, you know, voted for Trump but don't want to support him anymore. It's not totally clear how Christie is going to actually appeal to people personally. But, you know, there's been a lot of speculation and there might be something to it, that what he's really trying to do is just be the sort of targeted weapon that takes Trump down, rather than trying to win for himself. Mm-hmm. You know, that said, I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, there's a reason that no one's been able to succeed in doing this so far.
Well, that is the question, Alan, isn't it? Facing all these Republican candidates, that is it possible to really take on Donald Trump broadly, directly, and get the support of Republicans who vote in the primaries?
Yeah, I mean,
they're all struggling with that, it seems.
It definitely hasn't been proven electorally that it's possible, really, yeah, since his first run. And, you know, we've seen crazier things, but Chris Christie getting into the race at either flat 0 or 1%, it's very difficult to see that he would be the person who'd be able to overcome the former president. What will be interesting, though, obviously, if Christie gets on that debate stage in August, you know, he could try to wreak havoc or whatnot. But his entrance, as well as Mike Pence's entrance into the race, combined with the fact that you're seeing Ron DeSantis, even if he's not using Trump's name, he is starting to go after him a little bit harder, definitely harder than the other candidates who are already in the race. So you'll have a situation coming up, you know, as we look toward this August debate where, you know, most of the people on that debate stage potentially will be people who will be taking aim at Trump rather than what we saw during 2016, which was in those early debates. People were trying to essentially ignore him, fight with each other, and just like leave him unbothered, right, at center stage. I don't think we're going to see that this time. And I think Pence and Christie getting into the race further solidifies that.
Yeah, it's certainly 2016, they ignored Trump because they didn't take him seriously, right? In 2024 and 23 and 4, they're ignoring him maybe because they're afraid of him or afraid to take him on. But all right, so it's Tuesday, it's Chris Christie. Ginger, it's Wednesday. Here comes Mike Pence. He's almost the forgotten man in this primary so far. And he's the former vice president of the United States.
The former vice president of the United States, who, I mean, his story is just so complicated. One would think a former vice president, as our current president is, has a natural advantage to running for president. However, you know, this one ended his term by having the sitting president's supporters chant for his death at the Capitol, right? So this is obviously very different. I think the key here, and I think Alan makes a great point about Christie coming out swinging. Look at Nikki Haley, who's been running since February, also came out of the Trump administration, also was a Republican governor, also had been talked about prior to Trump as a potential presidential candidate. She's been running since February and her numbers have not budged. They have not moved a single point nationally, despite campaigning and spending lots of money. And she's trying to like straddle that line and not really criticize Trump and like echo some of his stuff and try to take credit for some of the good things, but not really criticize him on the bad things. It's not working for her. It's just not working. And I think the thing that people are going to be watching is when Christie, even if he gets in at 0, and Pence, if he gets in at 2 or 3 or 4%, can they move their numbers? Is something they're doing resonating or working. And Pence is going to also try that, like, I was part of it, but I was not there for the bad stuff. I'm not to blame for the bad stuff approach. Christie's going to try the, like, I was there and I think it's now all bad. And trust me, I was there. I saw it. It was bad. And if either one of them can start budging those numbers, I really think that we're going to see the rest of the field take note and imitate what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And if that means more aggressively attacking Trump, like Christie will, or that means taking the Pence approach and saying, well, it didn't work for Haley, but maybe it's working better for Pence. We're just going to see this start to be a process where they're all watching each other and figuring out what to do next.
Well, Gabe, I want to come back to you on the credibility issue you raised about Chris Christie. Mike Pence has the same credibility issue too, doesn't he? I mean, 4 years of standing by Trump's side and in every speech talking about how proud he was to be part of the greatest administration in the history of the country.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with Christie, at least you can see that he is, in some ways, you can interpret what he's doing as trying to chase the glory days of 2012 and 13, when everyone in the Republican Party wanted him to run for president before his Bridgegate scandal. And he had this incredibly good press. With Pence, you know, the rationale is really hard to see. Obviously, he's trying to run as, or he will be trying to run as a formerly Trump-aligned, you know, hardcore Christian conservative candidate, which is something that's a little bit different from what others are offering. It's, again, it's not totally obvious that there is a constituency for that. In the past, when people have made the argument for Pence to run for president, this is in the pre-Trump era, you know, it was, he's very conservative, but he's a smart guy. The Koch brothers are behind him. You know, a lot of that stuff has fallen by the wayside here. He has to walk this tightrope much more carefully than anyone else because, you know, at the end of the day, Christie, yes, he is associated with Trump, as I outlined earlier and as we've been talking about. Pence was literally on the ticket with him. He was in the White House with him.
Right.
You know, and yes, it's true that Christie broke from Trump when, you know, Trump gave him COVID. Well, Pence only broke from Trump when Trump seemed to be okay with protesters trying to find and kill him. Not to be glib about this, obviously, it's extremely serious, but these are questions that you know, Pence is going to have to answer and that he's sort of been able to elide so far. But the question of the lane is really a huge one. None of this is to say that Trump is, you know, just going to walk away with this thing, just that it's a big muddle right now. And the question of how you deal with the Trump record is the massive one. But it's a lot harder than it usually is when candidates are dealing with this kind of question because, of course, Trump is running.
Yeah. So in terms of announcements next week, I also understand that the governor of North Dakota, Doug Burgum, plans to announce next week. I haven't seen any date yet. And frankly, I don't know enough about him to ask a good question about him. So I'll just throw that out there and then move on to one who announced last week and he's trying to now established exactly how critical he's willing to be of Donald Trump, and that is Ron DeSantis. DeSantis starts out with an unusual little problem, which Donald Trump was quick to jump in and take advantage of, that DeSantis can't decide exactly how to pronounce his name. Is it DeSantis or DeSantis? Here's Donald Trump.
You don't change your name in the middle of a election. Change his name in the middle of the election. You don't do that. You do it before or after, but ideally you don't do it at all. Most people don't know what I mean. No, he's actually sort of changed the name.
It's sort of a silly issue, but it's getting a lot of attention about DeSantis. So how do you read his Iowa trip this week?
Well, I mean, just on Namegate, I can't imagine this having much staying power, but he also doesn't seem to be able to give an answer that will make this story go away.
Why doesn't he just have a news conference and say, this is how you pronounce my name, right? I am Ron DeSantis, or whatever he wants.
Now, at the same time, he has been going after Trump harder than the other existing candidates who were in the race. You've seen him go after Trump for signing the First Step Act. You've seen him go after Trump for his handling of COVID. And, you know, he's really starting to go after Trump for saying Florida is really bad and Andrew Cuomo did a better job handling the pandemic than DeSantis did, which in a Republican primary is something that I think probably makes little sense to voters. The other thing he's been going after Trump on is the fact that he can only serve one more term if elected.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's saying, look, Republicans, you need me. You need the full 8 years because the stuff we want to do is going to take dogged, you know, focus for 8 straight years to really make an impact. If it's only 4 years, this stuff's going to get reversed as soon as somebody else gets in there. And of course, Trump's comeback to this is, well, I can do every single thing within 6 months. And if DeSantis is saying he needs 8 years, you don't want him as your president. So you're seeing them start to fight back and forth over this point. But I think DeSantis had an answer that you're going to hear more of when he was actually pressed by NBC's Gabe Gutierrez yesterday when he said, you know, what do you think about Trump saying he can do all this stuff within 6 months? And DeSantis says, well, then why didn't he do it in the 4 years he was in office? So it's, that is going to be a debate I think we really see play out on a debate stage. You know, if Trump does show up for those early debates, I think that's going to be a real focal point. And, you know, it's an issue that we actually have been covering at NBC a little bit earlier on in the cycle is something that, you know, Republicans were saying this is going to be a focal point for people who actually want to go after Trump. The fact that he can't serve two terms if elected.
It is. Go ahead, Rick.
Can I just jump in on the.
Please. Yeah.
I think Alan is exactly right. But let me, as a fellow. You may have remembered my last name. I have some thoughts on the way that they're fighting about these last names. Just to talk about this on the merits, this is insane. I say my last name both ways depending on the situation that I'm in. It's absolutely not an issue. And the idea that people are reacting so gleefully about the fact that he is, for different audiences, saying his name differently is just sort of this like weird little ignorance. Not to you know, overplay it here. If I'm trying to say my name in a way that, you know, I want people to write it out or understand it, I'll say it slowly, I'll say Di Benedetti. If I'm just talking casually, I'll say Di Benedetti. It's not as if DeSantis is trying to secretly hide who he is, and I will step down from my soapbox now. But that, let me just leave my Italian-American lecturing there.
Well, I just think the problem is that you and Ron DeSantis have too many syllables in your last name. You know, I'm one of those blessed with one syllable. So,
as an Italophile, Bill, I'm disappointed in you.
As someone with the last name Smith, I have little room to talk.
There you go. But Ginger, does Ron DeSantis, is he getting to the point right now where he's going to be more under the microscope and more in the focus? And is he ready for that? For example, one of the things that I don't think Alan mentioned that is a line of attack for Ron DeSantis is that Trump didn't fire Anthony Fauci when he should have. And CNN a couple of days ago came up with this little clip of Ron DeSantis in March 2020, right in the middle of the COVID crisis.
From Dr. Birx to Dr. Fauci to the vice president, who's worked very hard, the surgeon general, they are really doing a good job. It's a tough situation, but they're working hard.
Praising Fauci and attacking Trump for not firing Fauci, Ginger.
I think it's an open question how much the American public wants to go back and relitigate the 2020 response. But I absolutely think this is a thing we're going to hear talked about both in this Republican primary and in the general election. Look at the Virginia governor's race last year or a year before last. It was a topic that came up there. It was something that Glenn Youngkin used to criticize Democrats and to make his case for governor. I think we're going to be hearing it again. I think that Republicans are keyed up to talk about it. So they're going to be talking about it in their primary as well as their general, and the general, regardless of who wins. And I think that the big question here too, the overarching thing that we're watching play on this Republican primary is how the candidates in the primary and then in the general litigate Trump's 4 years in office. How do they talk about that time there? Some of the things like he churned through 7 cabinet secretaries in like a year and a half or 2 years at like, you know, whereas Biden had one. Like, we go back and discuss those things. And I think that Republicans are testing out where they can go with those things and where the voters are going to respond positively. And then we're going to have a whole nother round of it come the general election. There were so many deep problems in that White House that have been written about and that are known, but we've sort of, I think, all sort of blocked out because they were years ago and We're not dealing with that chaos anymore. And I think we're going to have a real revival of that discussion as Trump remains at the top of the polls and what a future Trump administration would look like given the way that the last one ended.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of breaking news. I just noticed the Department of Labor just announced 339,000 new jobs created in May. So the economy does keep booming along, despite still people, some people talking about fears of a looming recession. No signs of it yet. So let's go on to the guy who is the top of the ticket, regardless of all these people jumping in. At this point, some 30 or more points ahead of DeSantis in almost all the national polls. And yet, this week, Donald Trump was revealed, CNN, I think, was the first to report that the special counsel, Jack Smith, has now possession of an audio tape where Donald Trump is actually bragging about or talking about a top secret document that he has in his hand as a former president, knowing he shouldn't have it and can't really talk about it. Gabe, and this has a document dealing with a possible invasion of Iran. Gabe, is this just one more attack that's not going to make any difference to Donald Trump, or pretty more serious than that? What do you think?
Well, definitely more serious than that, because it's not an attack. It's evidence that a prosecutor has in a case that doesn't look like it's going very well for the former president. This certainly seems pretty bad if he is seen to be actively concealing highly classified information and you know, trying to get away with keeping it or not letting the government know about it. This is one of the cases that I think people who are interested in the legal travails of Trump have been really focused on, because there's not a lot of getting around the idea that he was, you know, hiding this classified information that he kept unlawfully from government investigators. If that, you know, if this follows it to its natural conclusion and he's found guilty, you know, that could be a very serious crime that he's found guilty of. Obviously, that's a long way away. But I think in terms of the political travails here, who's to say how far this goes? You know, Trump obviously has been saying this is the deep state, don't pay attention to it. But that's old hat at this point. You know, that's sort of baked in. And I don't think that a conviction on this, if we do get to that point, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, would necessarily change the political calculus. But, you know, these legal problems are piling up, and this one seems especially serious.
And does seem to undercut what has been so far the main defense of Donald Trump, right? Which is he had every right to do this or didn't really know about them. And we'll see how that plays. So last night on Fox News, there was a town hall, Sean Hannity interviewing Donald Trump. I admit I didn't watch it. I'm not sure how many of us did, but we know Alan Smith did because he was tweeting about it. So, Alan, I'm going to tee you up. The Hannity Fox town hall last night, Donald Trump, what are the highlights?
Well, I'll tell you what. If you didn't watch it, you didn't really miss out, because I would say virtually no news was made. One of the things I thought was most interesting from it, honestly, was Hannity teeing up a question. You know, he's prefacing by essentially saying, you know, some Republicans want Trump to tone it down, enough with the name calling, et cetera, et cetera. And as Hannity is giving this preamble, the crowd starts booing. and there were a few people who shouted out, "No," which I thought was a little telling, because, you know, this is obviously going to be something that is debated during the Republican primary. You know, Trump's rivals, including DeSantis, you know, which he's been hinting at, they might start going, you know, "Look, we like what you did, but we just, it's too much drama. We don't want the name calling, you know, it's mm-hmm. just, it's juvenile," mm-hmm. as DeSantis said yesterday. And then you've got, you know, a room full of the former president supporters booing and saying, "No, that is exactly what we want."
Right. One big difference, Ginger, about last night, this was Fox News, and the town hall was pre-taped. So they taped it ahead of time, unlike CNN, did not carry it live. And apparently they edited out any of Donald Trump's assertions that he won the 2020 election. First of all, because it's a big lie, but also because Fox didn't want to be sued again for putting out false, knowingly putting out false information they knew was false. It looks like they learned something from CNN here, Ginger.
We live in some strange times, Bill. Let me just say that. I mean, I think that how we cover Donald Trump's campaign over the next year and a half, however long he remains in this campaign, but even if then, however long he remains in public life, is going to be a real, real chapter in some journalism textbooks for the future. I think there's a lot of challenges. Look, if you told me as an editor that one of my reporters had time to sit down and interview Donald Trump, I'd say, take it, go, ask him hard questions, do it, right? And we should be. He's running for president. But Fox really demonstrated last night that the challenges are there and that they have to weigh things like knowingly publishing or disseminating false statements. They got sued over it, obviously, so that's a complicating factor for them. And I just think we're all going to be trying to figure this out for the next year. And I know I'll probably get it wrong at least once and have to step back and say, was that the right decision? We should all be stepping back constantly and asking ourselves, was that the right decision? We can't ignore him away, which is what some people would say. And it is our obligation to the voters to be telling them what the candidates are saying and what they want to do and what their plans are. And we have to. And so it's a challenge. And I think Fox and CNN, and I'm sure my network, you know, my bosses will face many challenges and hard decisions, and the decisions will be difficult from the top all the way down to the intern who has to write something at some point, right? We all have to be thinking about it and weighing those decisions.
And the question I have is, back to CNN, did CNN suggest that they pre-tape it, but Donald Trump turned that down? Or did CNN not even consider pre-taping and just go live? We don't know that. Maybe we'll find that out someday when Chris Licht writes his memoirs, but maybe not until then. Okay, well, what a week it has been. It promises to be another exciting week next week. And a big thank you to Ginger Gibson, Gabe DeBenedetti, and Alan Smith for walking us through the news of the week. But as great a job as you did, we're not going to let you go before we find out what was the one story this week, either one you were working on, have been working on, or your colleagues covered, or just something you happened to catch that really caught your attention more than anything else. So where do we go? Hey, Gabe, how about starting us off?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to start with a story that I was reading and rereading and rereading yesterday in the New York Times about a lovely stretch of historic Georgetown, D.C. The headline of this story is, "When the Neighbors Don't Share Your Vision, and That Vision Involves Transformers Statues." To make a long story short, a very wealthy Georgetown professor has decorated the outside of his home in central Georgetown, Washington, a very lovely, quiet, historic area, with two massive Transformers statues from the Transformers movies. And it is truly a delightful story that I really want to just highlight. I want to suggest that everyone read it and highlight one quote that's deep in the story, referring to the characters themselves. One of the advocates of this professor says, "People have misunderstood the issue. You talk about compatibility with a historic district. Technically, these guys are millennia old. I mean, they're prehistoric." I just really want everyone to read this thing and reread it and frame it.
Well, all of my friends in Georgetown are alarmed about this, or not alarmed about it, but everybody's talking about it. So that was a big story. Alan, what caught your attention?
Well, I'm going to try my best to not tout the story that I did yesterday on problems in Republican canvassing. But instead, I'm going to mention a story that we had at NBC News today from Henry Gomez and Natasha Karecki on how Casey DeSantis is becoming a focal point of DeSantis' campaign, and the contrast really that's going to be drawn with how much she's out there speaking on his behalf and alongside him, and Trump, who, you know, you really have not seen Melania on his side since the announcement.
Wow. Yeah, that's a very interesting story for sure. In fact, we haven't seen much of her for the last 2 years, right? Or year and a half, whatever it's been. A big contrast. And we'll see what Trump's response to that would be, too. Hmm? How about and Ginger, your favorite story of the week?
Well, Bill, I have to tell you, this played out not like I expected it, because I was planning to talk about the Transformers story before.
Including
my favorite line in that story, Sally Quinn calling Georgetown a beautiful, quaint village. So I will second that. But I also picked this story because I thought Alan would talk about his fantastic story that published this week. And since he didn't, I will take the opportunity to tell you about this wonderful piece that Alan Smith spent 6 months investigating, looking at Republican door-knocking operations and the deep problems that exist in some of these operations and vendors that have real problems, including an example he gave about a door knocker who indicated they had knocked on several doors, but were actually 8 miles away in a casino, not knocking on doors in the Nevada Senate race last year, and a race that was really important and that Republicans lost in the 2022 midterms. He took a deep dive into sort of what are the problems that Republicans are facing on door knocking, how they're paying people who are not doing the jobs that they are telling them that they're doing, how they have just been plagued, and a really fantastic quote where someone said, you know, this is why we're losing. That's why we're losing elections, but nobody wants to admit it. So a really great read on this problem, and highly recommend Alan Smith's story. Republicans are spending millions on turnout operations that are deeply flawed.
That was a great story, Alan. I must say, I have walked, I have knocked on thousands of doors as a political volunteer, and without getting paid one dime for any of it. And I think once you start paying so-called volunteers, either to make phone calls or to knock on doors, or to collect signatures for an initiative or something like that, you are bound to get in trouble, because once money's involved, you're going to have people cheat at the system. And Alan pointed out that is very much, very much going on these days. Good job, Alan. Well, my favorite story of the week, a name resurfaced this week that we haven't heard from in a long time, and I'd rather totally forgotten about. And that's the name of a woman by the name of Tara Reid. We first heard about her in 2020. She's a woman who came forward and accused Joe Biden, then a United States Senator, of sexually, I don't know, assault was the word she used, but taking advantage of her in a hallway when he was a United States Senator and she was an intern working in his office. The president denied it. She was kind of discredited at the time, and nothing ever happened to that. She resurfaced yesterday because 2 days ago she announced that she was abandoning her United States citizenship and becoming a Russian citizen. She was defecting and going to join Vladimir Putin as a citizen of Russia. She's a longtime fan of Vladimir Putin, has been tweeting about what a strong man he is. So to that sense, maybe it came as no surprise. I am not one who engages in conspiracies, but I know some people will be saying, maybe she was a Russian agent all along. Just throw that out there and leave that for you to ponder. And with that, again, a big thank you to Ginger Gibson, Senior Washington Editor at NBC News Digital, Gabe DeBenedetti, National Correspondent at New York Magazine, and Alan Smith, Political Reporter for NBC News. Thank you, guys, and thanks to all of you for joining us here on the Bill Press Pod and today's Reporters Roundtable. Have a great weekend. Come back Tuesday for the next edition of the Bill Press Pod. We're going to be talking with Stephen Vladeck, a professor from the University of Texas, who's written a very important new book about the shadow docket, pointing out that some 98% of the work of the Supreme Court happens in the shadows, in the dark, in the middle of the night. We don't know anything about it, and these are consequential decisions. It's the latest big scandal, I think, to hit the United States Supreme Court, and we'll be talking about that with Steve Vladeck on Tuesday. We'll see you then for the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.